on having fixed it. And most importantly, good morning to our guests. We have come from great distances all over the country. And special good morning to the professor over there, who is now becoming part of the furniture. In Parliament, which is good, not a bad thing. And thank you for being here today. We like to hold these hearings in a fairly relaxed fashion because we really think that part of the value of calling you here in Sunday courses, the English and so on, is so that we can share your experience, we can really see every platform that we can really take that into your confidence and speak to us about something that is your passion, and hopefully it's a passion that is shared by all of us here today. And so we'll operate on the following basis. We give you each 10 minutes to make a presentation. Bearing in mind that we all have copies of your written submission, which you've already submitted to us. And really, yours is to use this opportunity to highlight the key issues and the most pressing issues from your perspective. Now, ideally the intention, and maybe I should just do what I do at every hearing, which is to reiterate closing and where this part of the hearing fits into the broader process. In January, actually last year in November, we issued an invitation to everybody to make submissions to us on the issue of access to and equality education in South Africa, obviously pertaining to schools in particular. We received a whole host of submissions, and some of the submissions we received, we then thought we should actually engage with you on. Firstly, on the basis that the kind of things you were saying that required elucidation, and more discussion and perhaps clarification. But also we gave a priority to people who are practitioners, so teachers, principals, and schools, and so on. We've also received a whole host of submissions from NGOs working in the field of education, from individuals who have done some wonderfully innovative things in their respective fields. So we thought that would also be a platform for them to come and showcase some of what they've done. As a result of the fact that they've received so many submissions, we obviously could not invite every single person to come to this, what I call the oral stage of the hearing. And we then had to select on the criteria that I've just spoken to. We hope to next week, we're finalizing our oral stage this week, at the end of this week. And next week we will go back to each and every written submission and we will pull out from those submissions the key points and we will try and discern and make godlike effort on the part of our content advisor and researcher. We will try and pull that all together into a report, which will be tabled in the National Assembly for adoption. And if the House adopts it, with the recommendations, those recommendations and the report will go to the Department of Education for implementation. To the enormous credit of the Department, they have asked over there to keep a watching brief over these things so that if there are issues and innovations that we come across that they would be very keen to implement right away and include into some of their existing review processes, whether it's curriculum or anything else, they will immediately through Palesa take on board some of these issues and incorporate them into existing So that's really the process, and that is how we envisage the process. We hope, of course, to have a debate in the House once the report is out. Hopefully that would be something that you would keep an eye on. And certainly what we will try and do is to give you copies of the report that we eventually table and adopt in the House of in the National Congress. So that being that, that is the plan. But of course we all know that things go awry. There are charges in KwaZulu-Natal and all kinds of interesting things happening in the world, and WikiLeaks has now become the official newspaper of the world, showing up journalists in a really bad way. So things can change overnight, you know. But that's the plan, anyway. So welcome to all of you once again, and let us begin with our first presentation, which will be from Dr. Isma, from Dr. Yusuf Dawood Primary School. Welcome to you, Dr. Isma. 10 minutes to address the committee, and then what we'll do is we'll engage with yourself on some of the issues that the members will pick up and so on.
Good morning. Salam, Dumela. I want to applaud this House for conducting this exercise and giving me this opportunity of making myself heard. I'm going to just highlight on a few aspects. I'm teaching for 31 years, and the last 22 years as manager of the school. The first aspect I'm looking at teacher development. Student teachers spend very limited time in colleges in practical training. They must, I suggest, at least once a week. There's a desperate need for laboratory training, secondary school, practical training. When our children go to university first year, they have problems. The second aspect is the managing capacity in schools. We are using an admin software, as you saw there. This could be steamrolled to all the schools in the country. Admin clerks in the schools should be trained in the utilization of this software. It reduces a lot of admin work for principals. It makes our schools very ready to function in the new year. As far as school maintenance is concerned, to get rid of this problem of minor repairs and maintenance, ensure that all schools in South Africa are granted Section 21A function. School safety, we do need guards at night. That will prevent me, especially as a principal, from going 2 in the morning to the school when there's vandalism. School library, I will stress immediate intervention. We need qualified school librarians. We need a software to ensure that there is somebody is able to catalog, classify this book. It would be feasible, advisable, to introduce a diploma for school librarians. I myself was trained as a school librarian. There's a link between library and the manner in which our learners produce their work. Physical education suggestion in the foundation phase, we have one PE teacher. In the intermediate phase, we have two physical education teachers. And the post-establishment school should include this. As far as the foundation phase is concerned, I would strongly recommend that there must be some form of oral testing of our learning regarding phonics, spelling, and oral communication. And the House definitely needs to look at the teacher-pupil ratio in the foundation phase. Should be very low. I would recommend at least 1 to 35. The promotion of literacy. You know, Fidel Castro, he mentioned Cuba will be the first country of America that will, after a few months, will be able to say it does not have one illiterate person. Ladies and gentlemen, these are some of the things that I mentioned. I do remain very positive as far as education is concerned. lot of changes have been made, a lot of positive changes have been made. And I just want to end with the following words of former President Nelson Mandela. Make every home, every shack or entity, a structure, a center of learning. I thank you.
Thank you very much, Dr. Umar, for the pithy way in which you've started your presentation. And you've touched on very many issues. I'm sure members would want to engage with you on. Let me just see an invitation. Mr. Larimer, Mr. Dubai, and Dr. Plotis Lawrence. Okay. Anybody else? Happy? Go ahead. You'll just take note of the questions, Dr. Ismail, and then what we will do is at the end of all of the questions, I'll give you an opportunity to respond.
Dr. Ismail, I'm interested here, you're talking about food security. Over the last 5 or 10 years, can you give us a picture of how often the issue has come up? Vandalism is an issue. Have you had some of the people stealing things too? Can you just give us a picture of what it's like and how often does this become a concern?
I think from my side, just to get an indication in terms of the school, the functioning, you know, of your SDGs, I guess that's just, you know, I have two issues around this. But again, in terms of being the discipline and making sure that the school actually teaches within your area of organization on how you manage that issue of teaching, teachers in class, you know, in class, and the discipline within the school.
My question is on the libraries. You are working with the organization Eco Education, with a slogan, one librarian for each and every school in our country. Do you have a strategy or a plan as to how to reach this goal or dream?
On the first question of school safety.
I'm not done with my question.
Oh, okay.
Still write down questions. Mr. Kanyako, it's my turn. When you had an opportunity, you didn't pick up your hand. It's my turn, and then I'm going to leave it over to Dr. Ismail. If there's a few minutes still with regards to the time allocation, I'll give it to you. Dr. Ismail, I have a few questions. Because your interest is so general, do excuse me, I'm going to just run through a whole lot of things. Okay? The first is, you say you utilize colleges to provide training, and again today you were saying you need a lot more practical, on-the-job kind of exposure as far as students are concerned. Now, why not university? Maybe you want to give me a practical experience that you may have had with regard to teachers in your school coming from universities as opposed to colleges. So maybe I want you to speak to that. There is this kind of argument about whether we need to reopen teacher training colleges to provide for training of teachers, or whether we should be training our teachers at universities. What's your view on that, right? The second is, you say subject inspection should be reintroduced. Now, clearly, from one perspective, that's a hugely controversial issue. What, in your view, is the worth of such inspections, and why is it that you would promote such a reintroduction? In your school, maybe you want to give us a sense of the makeup of your school. How many students do you have in your school? What is the student and teacher ratio? And is your school a more diverse school, or is it specifically geographically located for that particular geography? Because we've heard of schools sort of in Randburg, but they feeder schools for Toledo and further afield kind of things. Is that also your experience? And then when you say Section 21 functions to maintain school building should be decentralized to all schools, as I understand, the Section 21 functions are given to about 70% of all schools at the moment. But that would obviously include the issue of maintenance, surely. Is that not the case, or, you know, exactly what are you saying with regard to maintenance of the school building? And then, lastly, the grade 3 assessments. that you speak about, where you say there should be oral assessments for grade 3, particularly in regard to chronic and I guess numeracy as well. Do you find that, are you raising this because there is a problem with the way in which grade 3s are currently being assessed? And I'm talking about the external examination. Do you think that, I'm not sure how they assess, whether it's a written test or whether it's an oral test, but, you know, what exactly is your concern with what is happening currently?
Thank you. I do have a lot of questions, but I wrote quite a bit, and let's see my answer. As far as the school safety is concerned, fortunately in my school, from 1974 till 2010, I only had 3 burglaries because we have utilized SGB funds to appoint security guards within the school. I have 3 guards inside the school and at night. We have excellent support from the neighborhood watch, the police, our school safety police officers, but it is a general problem. We definitely needed, we had that in the past, so that's part of school safety. So we are using a lot of school money to sort problems out and working with the community, and I applaud the South African police for the services that they render. As far as the SGB function is concerned, I have an outstanding support from the school governing body. As principal, it is our responsibility also to train school governing bodies, and that's what we do. I have no problems as far as the school governing bodies concerned. As far as the discipline in the school is concerned, I am very proud that I have a very committed staff. There is no problem as far as late coming. Discipline is concerned. In fact, we start work at 7:25 in the morning. I report for duty at 6:30. I've been for 31 years. I haven't been absent for the last 30 years. I have no problems with learner discipline. As far as the school library is concerned, during the former House of Delegates days, around 1985, a diploma was created called the School Library Management Diploma. We did intensive training at the college, Springfield College in Durban. We spent our holidays there. This enabled us to teach book education in the school, explain to learners how to do reference techniques, and this is the way we promote literacy in the school. And that is why in those days the metric results were very good. I am not saying that we need to build a library. We can use classrooms, we can use the corridors, but what is very, very important, books are expensive. Although in our school we already started with electronic books and that, but what is very, very important, we need to ensure that in every school that there is a teacher library, a qualified teacher library. It is not worth giving money to the school to buy books when we don't have somebody to catalog the book, you know, Dewey Decimal Classification and so forth. And I'm sure with private partnership, we actually call in the parents to the school, and each parent has to donate a book. And in that way, I'm sure that we can sort this illiteracy problem out. As far as the colleges and universities is concerned, we have a medical school. And a medical school has pharmacists, dentists, and doctors. In the past, we had a college of education. And I learned to teach. That was the job of a teacher. As a teacher, I'm a teacher. I must teach. That's what a college is there. I learned how to write. I learned how to dress. I learned punctuality. But that was the college is there. We need to give the College of Education status. We need to bring back dignity in school. If we do not, we don't have to build a college. We can even utilize schools at night. But the colleges of education should be there like how we had it in the past. And I'm going to do my training. I do not want to hear long stories, I have a doctorate in education. I want to know, this is the curriculum, how I go about teaching the curriculum. That is the other things I can do. I can have all the degrees. I can do another doctorate. It's not going to help me. The job of the college is to teach the teachers to teach. And that is the responsibility of the colleges. When they are mingled with all other faculties, it's a problem. Then, subject inspection. Teaching is a about an individual standing in front of the class. That is extremely important. And what is important is, unlike other careers, if a teacher is trained correctly, in the proper manner, like a medical doctor, they don't need somebody standing there to perform an operation. If the training is done initially at the highest caliber, you won't have a problem. So you start, teacher development needs to start in the college. Five subject inspections, we need a qualified subject advisor who's competent in their English, whether he has English 3 or geography, to guide teachers when they need it. I just don't need your report. I don't think so need you can go to 27,000 schools. It's impossible. We need to look at the subject within the school and guide the teacher in a professional manner. There must be a mechanism where I, as a teacher, if I'm not happy the way I'm treated, that I can take it at the next level. As far as I am a principal of Dr. Yusuf Dado Primary School, it has some great art to grade 7. I have 1,200 learners. Most of my learners are from the informal settlement. I do have about 40% Indian, the rest are Africans and colored. I have no problems. The school has opened its doors from 1990. Most of our learners don't. We don't know much of the past, we are living in the future. We assemble very, very well. We had very good support from the Housing Department of Education. We do have our own feeding scheme in the school. We have generated a lot of money. I just raised R1 million and built my own school hall. As far as the learner population, there's a good feeling among the learners to learn. It is positive. And in fact, the grade 3 results in that we are over 50%, the norm. As far as section, you get two types of school. You get section 20 and section 21. We apply for section 21 function. What I'm saying here is section 21, as far as the maintenance is concerned, that should be allocated to every school. We apply for section 21 function. But as far as the maintenance of the school is concerned, that should be allocated to all the schools so they can, the budget must be given to them so they can carry out minor repairs in the school. I want to thank some of the municipalities that assist us in maintaining the school if we request such assistance from the local municipality in terms of tractors and that. And you know, my school only charges R800 a year school fee, only 40% of those. Parents pay, but we enjoy a very good relationship with the business and so forth. I think what is extremely important is the ability of us to look at a problem and sort that problem out. As far as the grade 1 learning is concerned, you mentioned grade 3, but I'm looking at grade 1. In grade 1 in the past, what should happen is that before a child gets to formal work, we should test the child in terms of color, asking them basic things. Once they are able to identify the color, right leg, jump, passing, or whatever, then you should put the children in formal work. You see, it is very easy to look at something in paper and put a cross and write. I remember when I was in school, when I threw a false question, I knew I'd get some marks, because I put a cross, maybe something wrong, okay, right. I just say that there should be some form of oral testing done by some people out there. So this will give us an indication, can our learners, our children do things orally?
Thank you very much. I think she touched on the issue of inspection. I don't know if the media has been very careful that the media is talking about inspection. But my question is, how do we change the attitude of teachers towards inspectors? If you say we have to increase hear some suggestions in case you say, well, how would you change the attitude of you know, teachers in general to accept inspectors? Principals accept inspectors because they know that on their side they're going to have them, but teachers speak differently. Thank you.
Look, at the moment we use the IQMS, let's say Integrated Quality Management System, to inspect teachers internally, but we don't have a system external inspection. We don't have people from the district offices that do come and inspect. They look at our books, and I myself teach and so forth. But as far as it is a very burning question, and I think the manner in which the secretary spoke to me and dealt with me, it gave me, I felt like a human being, the manner this committee dealt with me. I think what is very, very important, you need to understand that we are burdened with a lot of work, but we also need somebody to check on our work so that we can grow. What I would suggest is that we look at subject inspectors, not looking at an individual, looking at the subject, say example history in grade 5, that we go into the school and we go into the classes in a professional manner. We sit and we listen to the manner in which teachers teach. And if you give them the correct advice without blaming or insulting and so forth, I think that will go in a long way. But at the moment, within the school, the principal, the HOD, deputy, and we're getting good support from the district officials as far as inspections within the school is concerned.
Now you're just, you know, when we say you gave the finger and then somebody's taking the hand, you've now just taken the whole one. I want to suggest, Aniyata, that you speak to Dr. Ismail after the session, maybe over to you or something, okay? And then you clearly have a lot to speak about. But what I am most interested in is the fact that you've not been absent for 30 years. Now, that reminds me of a wonderful story that I have when I was we came across a guy, his name is Black Swat. Happens to be neither Black nor Swat, because he's Afrikaner. And he started in the Justice Department as a clerk, you know, one of these messenger-like youngsters, straight out of school. And he worked his way up into becoming the chief magistrate of the court. And he was, when he retired, he was the chief magistrate in Athlone. Mitchell's Plain. And he retired a few years ago, 3-4 years ago, and in his, at his farewell function, he stood up, somebody stood up and said, you know, I went through the file, and I see that he has not been absent a single day for 45 years, but 2 years ago, he was absent for 3 days because his doctor booked him off. So for 45 years, he took 3 days sick leave. And then Mr. Swart came to collect his nice little watch and so on, token of appreciation. And he said, you know, I am suing that doctor for booking me off for 3 days. I'm so angry with him. So, Mr. Ismail, I don't know how you keep healthy. Because I would have thought that with all those young kids, you would be most susceptible to colds and flus and coughs and wheezes and so on. But all strength to you, and whatever you have for breakfast in the morning is what I want for breakfast in the morning. Thank you very much, and thank you for coming. And I do hope that you'll sit in the rest of our session and benefit from some of the other submissions as well, and then hopefully we can still engage with you afterwards. Thank you so much. We'll go on to the next submission, which is from Mr. Colbert. Are you doing the submission on behalf of CESCO? Go ahead, 10 minutes.
Thank you, Madam Chair, members of the committee. Thank you for the invitation also. to come and do an oral presentation. Before I proceed, I'd just like to introduce a gentleman sitting to my right, who is my boss. He is the Eric Wolf, the National Chairman of Texas, Tectonia, and Chairman of two very chairman of the governing body, two very successful schools. It's a pity that Mr. Van Heeper has left us now, because I had in the past we both lobbied for a longer time for associations and national bodies to address the committee, because I think we can spend the whole day with what we have to say about the education, because of the fact I think that we have a country-wide perspective on what is happening in education. We represented in all nine provinces, the largest governing body association, and also the oldest governing body association in the country. Madam Chair, I'm speaking from the perspective of extremely successful schools. In our written submission, I have given you a breakdown of the matric pass rate of our members in last year's matriculation exam. The average for the country is 96.5% pass rate. You'll find that on page 3 of our submission. At the same time, I think it's fair to say that we have one of the worst performing education systems in the world, not because of the fact that there is of necessity a problem with the structure itself. There's one problem with the structure, which I will return, but which is not part of the legal and regulatory framework of education in the country. I also think, Chair, we have to learn from international experience. With regard to that, I'd like to refer the committee to two excerpts that I've made from the reports, international reports on education. If I look at the invitation of the committee, the first part of the invitation of the committee focuses on the quality of education, and the second part on access. With regard to, if I can start with access, many of you will probably know Dr. Louise Grouch, who was very involved with the establishment of the new education system in South Africa. And Mr. Becker will be able to enlighten you about his role in the whole process. I quote from what he said in Washington. The problem with South African education is not a lack of funding. South Africa spends substantially more on education than most low and middle income countries whose school systems significantly outperformed ours. Nor is the problem one of access. Because school enrollment levels in South Africa are very high. What we have is a serious problem of performance and efficiency in South Africa. South Africans are receiving a very poor return on a substantial investment. If I have time, I'll come back to the statement with regard to the fact that the problem is not funding. Overall, yes, it's not funding, it's the way in which the funds are utilized. With regard to quality, the first part of your invitation deals with quality. We have the McKinsey report, and I'm sure members of the committee have already seen the McKinsey report. If you have not seen it, Chair, I would encourage or request members to read the McKinsey report on the world's best performing school system. They captured three conclusions after an investigation of 25 systems all over the world, including the 10 best systems in the world. And they say three things. The first thing they say, they get the right people to become teachers. And then the very famous statement they made, the quality of an education system cannot exceed the quality of its teachers. The second one, they develop these people into effective instructors. The only way to improve outcomes is to improve instruction. The third one, they put in place systems and targeted support to ensure that every child is able to benefit from excellent instruction. The only way for the system to reach the highest performance is to raise the standard of every student. I would like now to focus on our recommendations. We have set out some recommendations in our submission, but I'd just like to highlight some of them. The first issue I'd like to highlight is that our system needs to encourage success. With that, what I mean is that we need to create a new model of schools with greater autonomy. These highly performing schools, and I'm not talking about high schools only, I mean the results I have listed on page 3 of my written submission, is also the result of good education in primary schools. It starts there, it starts at grade R, or even maybe before grade R. But we cannot say that it's only the matriculants that need to get the credit, or the matric teachers. It's the whole system in those successful schools. Those schools, we would suggest, should be given more authority, more autonomy, for the arrangement of their own affairs. And there are excellent models in other countries. I've just returned from a tour through the United States, Holland, England, and I've just attended an international conference where we had quite a lot of speakers from Finland, the most successful system in the world. And I think we can really learn from them with regard to how they arrange their schools. As far as funding is concerned, back to what the Elite Scouts has said, the problem is not a lack of funding. Yes, it is certainly not a lack of funding, because of the entire system, we're spending per capita more than most other countries in the world. The problem is that money is not reaching the schools. I would really like the committee members to invite the relevant officials of the department. We worked with Mr. Faroz Patel, previous DDG of systems planning in the National Department of Education, and he told us horrific stories about the money that gets lost in the system that is not, cannot be accounted for, the money that should be going to schools. If you look at what we said in our presentation, in our written submission, with regard to the role of officials, if today you close district offices in this country, nothing would happen to education. They might not make any significant contribution to the quality of the education in our country, to the performance of the system. Madam Chair, they're supposed to monitor. I'm not exactly sure what they're supposed to do. And they themselves are not sure. When speaking at this international conference last week, I was approached by members of district offices who told me that they've been in district offices for 3 years now, they don't have a job description, they don't know what to do. They themselves applauded me when I said close the district office. They're simply making no contribution. Let me just take this for an example. In the Free State, where I come from, I like to refer to it as the center of the universe. In the center of the universe, we have 1,547 public schools. There are 2,300 officials employed at the provincial and district offices. Now, if you have to make a quick calculation of what that must cost us, those 2,300 officials, it must be an excess of R1 billion. If that R1 billion is not making a significant contribution to the outcomes of the schooling system, why don't you then divert that to those places where the difference should be made, and that is at the school level. We really need to look at the whole structure of provincial offices and district offices. And certainly, we'd be prepared to undertake in our membership research on exactly what contribution they do make. You'll see from our written submission that they don't actually make contribution. But I think we can go further into that. And then the portfolio committee could even go as far as conducting an investigation into the contribution. Is it really worth the money we're spending? The answer is going to be no, I promise you that. Chair, in line with what the McKinsey report has said, in line with our own experience, and also I was very impressed by what I heard from Dr. Ishmael about the teachers. It is the teachers that make the difference. As far as teacher leave is concerned, Ms. Quebecca would be able to tell you that there is a study underway. I've been part of the task team conducted by the National Department, assisted by the CSIR, on the teacher study leave. The numbers are horrific as far as teacher absence from school is concerned. That is where the second most serious problem in our education system lies. Even the president last year in his address to the principals in Durban referred to the fact that the majority of teachers in South Africa are only teaching 50% of the time they're supposed to be in the classroom, 3 hours instead of 6.5 hours as prescribed by the time on task regulations with regard to teaching. I'd like to support what Dr. Ishmael has said about the reopening of certain colleges. From our experience as school governors, we have to make recommendations for the appointment of teachers at primary school level. And I've been involved in this long before the teacher colleges were closed. I've been in the school governor since 1988, the old dispensation. And we gave preference in the primary school to those teachers who came from the colleges because they were, as far as the training is concerned, much better equipped to teach primary school children. It's all good to have an academic degree and very good qualification, but there's also research showing, and I'd refer you to research done by Dr. Muawiya Khalid of the Pretoria University that shows that the higher the actual academic qualification of teachers, the lower the performance of the school. They then become more involved with their own academic careers than with the learning of these children. Governors play an exceptionally important role. In our schools, we have very successful governance structures, governing bodies. They train, they're well equipped for the task. And I really think that we should invest more in the training of volunteers, the assistance of volunteers, the type of work that we do on a daily basis.
I want to point out to you that you've now taken 15 minutes to present, and we're going to run out of time when members want to ask questions. So, how do you just round up a bit?
Okay. I can deal with if the governor issue comes up. As far as physical and ethical values are concerned, an extremely important aspect. We're engaged with the National Department about strategy. We've been into that. And then, as far as media is concerned, Chair, I was a member of the task team, and as far as inspection, et cetera, is concerned, we've said, I have at least said what I wanted to say about inspection and monitoring in the NIBU's report. I'm at least glad to see we now have the NIBU Council, and I trust that NIBU would get us down very successfully because we really do need that type of structure in our system. Thank you, Chair.
Thank you very much. I'm going to open up for questions. Mr. Larimer, Dr. Sloan, Ms. Schwana. Hello, Mr. Mustafa. Mr. Mustafa.
Thank you, Chair. Three questions. You highlight solution to the problem of uncommitted teachers? How do you think that should be? Secondly, you're quite critical of school districts, and I think it's quite apparent that there are a lot of problems with school districts. Are they necessary? Could they be useful if they were reformed?
I want to refer to two sentences in your presentation, your document. You mentioned the failure to appoint teachers. Do you have statistics on certain unions and the interference when it comes to the appointment of teachers, and specifically also principals? And in the following sentence, teachers still being ordered to attend training and other workshops during schooling hours. What is the view of your organization when it comes to teaching for school, teaching being declared an essential service? Me and my colleague, Mr. Solomon, feel very strongly about the fact that education should be declared in an essential service. Thank you.
Thank you, Chairperson. I have a smile and a cough this morning that I guess you'll be able to hear my voice. Thank you for the presentation. My understanding is that the issue is about quality and access, and I heard you talk of quality. But I want to check with you as to the access of all the schools to the members of FEDFAS, because I'm talking of the whole country, and I want to check if it's possible for all schools, any school which wants to be a member, except the senior school, the senior medium Afrikaans and English school, as well as 12 medium and Southern school. That's my first question. And the second one is about the pass rate on page 3. You talk of members pass rate. I think the schools that are members of first time, this is their pass rate. But when I look at this, it's like the provincial pass rate that you are reflecting here is inclusive of all schools to the best of my knowledge. Like these ones, it's exactly the way they are, reflecting even the other schools. But I see you have got your 97.15 for member states and only 48, whereas my understanding is that 48 is inclusive. Can you unpack that to me? Thank you very much. Would you support that kind of model?
the issue of funding, and you raise that quite starkly, you know, where you say schools that can manage it, that are successful, is the word that you use in your submission, should be given the ability to budget their own funds and so on. So some teacher salaries to maintenance to everything else. Now that's quite a radical solution that you're proposing, and certainly one that clearly will not fly, given the issue of the teachers particular. Because look, at the moment what happens, as I understand, and you can correct me if I'm wrong, but schools get a specific allocation. Those schools that are marked or tagged Section 21 schools, they get their allocation except for the teacher provisioning allocations. In other words, the issue of salary is taken away, the burden is taken away from schools. And so for the rest of your budget, you'll be able to budget accordingly, but not your, your teacher posting. Now your solution is, let's get rid of all of that, let the school also hire and fire their own teachers and so on. Now clearly that creates huge problems. Firstly, one of the disparities. You could, for example, find individual schools picking up to the part paying teachers differently, for instance. And really the onus of teacher posting, I don't know anywhere in the world where, you know, unless it's a private school, where that is handled by schools themselves. Maybe if you've got an international experience with that, you might want to speak a little bit more, because your submission just seems to put this very starkly and it doesn't give a context to it. So I'm really just giving you an opportunity to do that. And then I think if we can get that report on teacher absence, that would be very good from the department, the one that was put into earlier. Sorry, I've got Mr. Matabela, who I completely and quite disrespectfully doubt here, particularly given that he is a very hard worker and all of those things. So sorry, Mr.
Matabela,
yet again.
Thanks, Chair. Just three questions. The first on page 3. You're talking of some political motive among officials, education officials. And that on its own would imply that there's no professionalism. Or else you may need to elaborate what you mean by that. You know? In my view, that and the statement that is being raised on page 7 under 4, in terms of undoing a parent and inclusion in the affairs of the to me, it was going to mean that probably the departmental officials will be approaching this school trying to enforce some regulations or some laws or policies. But in the state of the department, either are being violated or whatever, trying to strengthen or assist schools in that matter. And that you've got some elaboration as to exactly what we mean, which may not be within the professional limit of departmental officials, and that may be way out of that. The second issue would relate to, again, on page 6, I think paragraph 4, just before I can say that, we talked of the well-performing schools bearing the brunt of undue pressure that comes as a result of needing to accept more learners, and so on. To me, the challenge there was going to be either in terms of infrastructure or post. And what I know from the departmental level, or what we always have told is that as and when we involve more people or learners, the teacher-learner ratio will determine what sort of good people are. Well, in terms of infrastructure, yes, probably we may not be able to take them on board. But what else may be the challenges that have come as a result of that to the extent that LGBTs or your federation may then say, no, we think we can't be able to take them any more levels, and we are not in agreement with the department if you raise your issue to say, we cannot take more because either of infrastructure or whatever else, which are going to be affected that you think will affect the center involvement in a particular level. So that is not seen as your way of saying just putting a limit which may be based on other motives other than issues of early learning.
Thank you very much. And I see we've got some guests in the gallery. A very warm welcome to you to this very historic chamber. This is the meeting of the Historic Committee on Basic Education, and we are currently busy with public hearings on the issue of access to and the quality of basic education. And we have with us some guests from schools, from governing body associations, and members of the public who have a who are stakeholders in the education system. So very welcome and enjoy your visit to Parliament. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. With regard to the question of the Honourable Member Lorimer, the whole solution to the issue of uncommitted teachers is a debate for 3 hours. But once again, if I can just take an example of Finland. Within Finland and in some other countries, especially if you read the McKinsey report, then in those countries the status of the teacher is higher than that of other professionals, such as medical doctors, lawyers, etc., etc. It's going to be a long debate. They have to be paid properly. But they also have to be disciplined if they do not teach for 6 hours, half an hour. How on earth is it possible that you can have a majority of teachers not teaching the prescribed number of hours? Where are these district officials who are supposed to monitor them? The districts, are they necessary, Madam Chair, with regard to the East District, and it also touches on your question with regard to the circuits. It doesn't matter what you call it. One has to distinguish between structure and functions. And I think what the problem started when the functions were not properly identified and the structure was set up, districts or circuits or regions in some provinces they call, it doesn't really matter whether they're there or not. The question one must ask yourself is, what are they supposed to be? What functions must they perform? And what functions are they supposed to perform that schools, well-functioning schools, cannot perform themselves? I see only two things. And that is, number one, the funding of the system, and number two, relating to the curriculum, the prescribing the curriculum and monitoring the implementation of the curriculum. That's the only two things that they need to do. And in successful schools, these things are being done without their assistance. So, no, I don't think they're necessary at all. Provided those people that are in the system are well-trained, are committed, are people with a good work ethic, and they are performing what they're supposed to. Interference by units in appointments, no, I don't have statistics, but I can tell you that, and I'm not afraid to name it, the only problem that we've had with, from our perspective, and I've been involved in as lawyer and as CEO of the association, in probably about 100 disputes which have gone to court without the appointment, In most of it, it was officials that had turned down the appointments without any justification. In some of it, it was such and South is the only one that we have problems with. But I can't give you statistics. Education is an essential service, Madam Chair. I know it's controversial, but I'd say if we want our teachers to be regarded as professional people, they should not be workers. They shouldn't be in the union, in labor unions at all. They should be a professional association. And I think that if there is such a word, one must in the long term work to the deunionization of the profession of teachers. So I'm going further back than that and simply looking at the declaring it as essential service. That I think would be a quick fix problem to what is really a fundamental issue of professionalism. Professional people aren't organized in unions, they're organized in professional associations. And as long as they are in unions, and as long as they are threatening the system with strikes, etc., etc., they will get the image of professional people with a high status that they need in the eyes of the public. The questions with relating to the membership of FECLIS, yes, any governing body who subscribes to our constitution is on our website, can become a member. And that is public school governing body, but with regard to your very specific question, what do we regard as a white school then? I'm saying we don't have a single white school as a member. Maybe one. Our schools are all integrated schools. If you're talking about the 16-year-old idea of X Model C schools, yes, the majority of our members are X Model C schools. As far as XGT and X, we don't make that distinction.
We just ran out of time, so can I just ask you, do you have any schools that are based in Zanshu, African Zanshu?
Yes, indeed, and all over. In Transkei, in the old Transkei, our latest member is Lubisini Secondary School in Mount Fletcher. That's our latest member. I'd say XDET, HOH, and those schools, about 30% of our members are those members. And they're included in the statistics we've given them. I'm very sad to hear that you say that my suggestion of the more autonomous model will not fly. It is indeed flying very successfully in other countries. In England, it is the school governing body that appoints the teachers, and they are employed by the school governing body. They have a framework within which, by regulation, they have to pay. That happens all over the world. That is the situation in the Netherlands. That is the situation in the United States, in most of the United States, the individual states. All the countries that I've been to, that is exactly the model. It does work, and it does work very effectively. With regard to the last set of questions, the political motive, undue interference, etc., you're asking the question, are these officials trying to enforce policy or law? No, very often not. It's either a wrong interpretation of the law, a wrong interpretation of the policies, or their own perception of what the policies say. We deal with this on a regular basis, on a daily basis. Political motive with regard to appointments, with regard to admissions, with regard to language policy, with regard to racial issues, we're seeing far too many of them. But we won't complain if an official interferes in the affairs of a school governing body where the school governing body clearly has not complied with the law. And we certainly welcome, and we do welcome, reports to us about situations where our members may not have complied with the law. I can't recall one instance where that has been reported to us. It's fine. requests to national departments and provincial departments of education to report such matters to us so that we can set the matter straight by giving the governing body the correct guidance, correct information, correct training, etc. But in most of these cases, there's interference in discipline. The provincial department of education has only one right or power with regard to disciplinary issues, and that is where the head of department must decide on a recommendation for expulsion. When a governing body or a principal or a teacher disciplines a learner, the Department of Education and officials don't have any right to interfere, but they do that on a daily basis. They interfere in the management of the finances of the schools. They interfere in extracurricular, extramural activities. Once it's prescribed, they have no right to do so. And we really deal with these issues on a daily basis. And it brings us into conflict. We don't want that kind of conflict. And then as far as the last issue is concerned, the pressure to admit learners. A school can admit uncontrollably any number of learners. You have certain facilities. A school can have too many learners. It becomes unmanageable. When you have a school with 1,400 learners, typically what district officials do, they disregard the admission policy of the school and they go to principal and tell the principal, they push the principal to sign and say, listen, you shall admit this learner. And then you discover this learner is a friend's child or whatever, and they simply push these children into the schools. I can give you an example of what happened at the beginning of this year in an English medium school, a member of ours, where the school had a waiting room. It didn't have space for the learners. It didn't have the LTSN, the necessary material. It didn't have the physical capacity. It didn't have the teachers to accommodate those learners. So they had a waiting list of 40 learners. And this district official simply came and said to the principal, I'll discipline you if you don't take these other learners who weren't even on the waiting list. This is in disregard of the rights of those who had preference. When the governing body chairs, who, by the way, happened to be an Indian lady, tried to interfere, she was physically pushed aside and chased out of the office of the principal by the district official, who had absolutely no jurisdiction in the office of the principal. These are the things that are happening out there. This is what we're talking about when we're talking about undue influence, when we're talking about abuse of power, when we're talking about political issues.
Thank you very much. You still have one of the questions that you need to respond to.
No, I think I've dealt with every
question.
There's just one issue, that's the pastorate.
Very quickly.
Yes. The pastorate includes all our member schools only. If you look at page 3 of this submission.
I think that is self-explanatory. Thank you very much. Okay, we're going on to the next submission, and I'm sorry to cut you there, but you've taken 10 minutes out of the next presentation. I don't want to elaborate further on any of those questions, but please do stay behind so that members can engage with you later on. Next, we have in Livingston, Livingston Primary School, Mrs. Costa.
Yes, that's correct. Good morning, welcome, Chair.
Thank you.
To the committee. And thank you for the welcome and the hospitality and the opportunity to express our concerns. The two issues that, before I continue, please can I introduce my deputy principal, Mandy Williams. Our two greatest concerns are directed at the learning and the teaching in the classroom. We fully agree with the findings and recommendations made by the task team. Review the implementation of the curriculum and the positive steps that have been taken so far to effect change have been welcomed. We are concerned about the vast volume of concept skills and knowledge that are included in the curriculum. It is imperative that in the first 4 years of formal schooling, grade 1 to grade 4, firm foundations for future learning are laid. Concepts need to be well established, positive attitudes instilled, confidence and self-esteem need to be developed. In order to do this, teachers need to teach and learners need to learn at a pace conducive to the internalization and retention of concepts and skills. In my opinion, to keep pace with this vast volume, teachers have to rush through their teaching and learners do not have time to learn successfully. My main concern, however, at the primary school level, where we've been teaching, I've been teaching about 34 years, is that learners are expected to function at the level of abstraction and generalization far before they are ready. I refer here to Piaget's theory of cognitive development, where he says it's at the fourth stage, the formal operational stage, at around the 11 years of age, when this sort of abstract reasoning comes to the fore. This is usually about our grade 5 level. To illustrate this, I use the words of a 10-year-old in grade 4 being taught fractions. Oh, is that what they were trying to teach me in grade 2? All the learning areas, grade 6 is now to be called subjects, have abstract concepts which are beyond the understanding of little children. Math in particular, vast content, complex, sophisticated concepts, which take a lot of time for them to be absorbed, generalized, and been able to transfer. These concepts are rushed through at a tremendous pace. What impact does this have on the learners? They are so astute, immediately they lose confidence. They know that they are not coping. The teacher tries again and again to explain to them what they aren't able to do. They tend then to withdraw from the learning process. They no longer become involved with it. They become more and more reliant on the teacher's teaching and remembering what the teacher has taught them, rather than using their own thought process solve problems and to work through the task that's required of them. They become anxious, and this anxiety increases as the concepts and skills become more difficult and their pace accelerates. This eventually will turn into fear, and it's no need to say that this fear factor has a huge impact on all learning. Just recently, in the words of our grade 1 teacher, grade R is now the new grade 1. The demand, the content, and the expectations are increasing, and the pressure is being placed on learners and teachers much, much earlier. We regard learners as young children, not many mathematicians, historians, geographers, and economists. They need time to learn. They need to absorb what they are learning. They need to internalize it. They need to generalize and transfer their skills and have a sound basis for further learning. At present, we feel we are trying to teach on a sandy soil where the foundations are not there. We were very relieved when the foundations for learning were introduced. We felt that this would provide more structure, sequence, and the old word syllabus for us. But we found too that they are far too paced. They quite have hazards in their inclusion in the time frames and the milestones, and we find too that we're looping ahead and trying to cover things so that we can test. The teaching for testing seems to be coming back, which is not very sound educationally. While this is all happening, and while we're so involved with curriculum content and abstract concepts, we seem to be spending less and less time on developing the learners holistically, socially and emotionally, and they are being impacted negatively in these areas by the high demands on them. And then with regards to the learning and teaching support material, we're
I'm in favor of textbooks. I know they are going to be reintroduced, which is positive and will be beneficial. Teachers have no time to develop their own materials. We would love to see some of them develop a lot more, even if they have the capacity to do so. Some, unfortunately, don't. But textbooks and workbooks are structured and they do follow a sequence, but they don't provide the necessary revision, the necessary consolidation, and they need to revisit concepts. We need an integrated approach to these that subject, so that they don't visit it, do it, test it, move on. They need to continually be involved with repetition and consolidation. When they get to grade 5, to make up what they've missed out on, to move forward and go into high school. Fractional concepts form a mark important at grade 7 and 8 and 9 level for algebra. Algebraic expressions require a sound fractional concept, and these sound concepts are not being established early enough and well enough because they're introduced early in the children aren't ready for them. Thank you.
Let me just say that one of the things that particularly heartened with your presentation, simply because it does deal with the kind of practitioner issues.
Mm-hmm.
Certainly we've asked our content advisor, Mr. Bundy, to pull out those aspects pertaining to such matters. Curriculum, what is wrong with the curriculum, what is right with the curriculum, all of that, and pull that together in the report, and this certainly does help us a great deal to perhaps ring-fence some of the kind of alerts that we need to perhaps focus on when we do our recommendations to the department. So thank you very much for that. Members? Dr. Flopis Lawrence, Mr. Masabela, Mrs. Moshwana. Thank you.
Thank you. The many problems you mentioned about the curriculum boil down to the way in which the curriculum is drafted by our department. Since November last year, when the Minister, for the umpteenth time, announced the review of the implementation of the curriculum, I had during a speech in Parliament called for the establishment of a national curriculum development unit, a unit that will develop the curriculum scientifically. And the many problems you mentioned were encountered because curriculums don't get piloted in certain schools before they get implemented nationally. What are your views on my suggestion that we should establish a national curriculum development unit and start developing our curriculum on a scientific basis by scientific curriculum development?
Thanks so much. Just one or two questions. Now there have been some amendments to the OBE in terms of what should happen and so on. Your submission doesn't take into consideration some of those, particularly at the lower grades, so reducing from 9 million area to 6. The second, which is almost based on the first one, is just to understand to what extent is this submission being compared to what happens internationally. So if we are in the global west, or we are within the global village, it means our standards in South Africa should, to some degree, relate to what happens elsewhere. Is this submission to the greater extent that we take any comparison, or is necessarily what you think should happen with your experiences and so on? I'm not saying we can't necessarily have our own initiatives. I'm just interested in whether we're actually looking broadly to what happened, which I thought when the department comes up with whatever initiative, probably in what may be international standards.
Let me just finally add to that, and Mr. Marcello covered the ground on the issue of whether your submission has taken into account some of the proposed reviews that have been recently announced. And I take it that some of your points don't stand based on the fact that what you're raising now is that fundamental concept. You have to give time for consolidation. You have to give room and space for consolidation. You have to revise over and over again. Part of the problem, of course, seems to me, and you raise this in your presentation, is that we have what is called a curriculum statement. It seems to be quite broad. And teachers are meant to design their own sort of lesson plan around each of these so-called outcomes. And you made the point that not all teachers are able to do so, and those who do just don't have enough time to do it properly, perhaps. What, in your experience, is currently the situation in your school? Are your teachers able to cope with developing their own lesson plans, etc.? And would you like to see a situation where those lesson plans are actually developed by the department, whether in an institute or not, where there is at least certainty? So one of the things I said last week when we met the department was, I think that instead of ICMS, where you go and you evaluate whether teachers need support in any particular subject and so on, spend your time and your effort putting up a website. And every subject, every lesson, every subject, whether it's history, geography, English, whatever, have those lessons on the website so that they're easily accessible, not only to teachers who may need support in a particular area within a subject, whether it's math, reading, and geography, or whatever, but also to parents who have to help their kids with homework and who, you know, would have never done something like calculus. So that I could go onto the website and teach myself the basic fundamentals of calculus and then try and assist my daughter with her homework. What do you think, you know, should be done?
Right, thank you. Firstly, to your question, thank you. I definitely think that this, the curriculum should be looked at again and scientifically. I think in attempts to improve education and to improve results in that assessment are done, and we tend to overdo put more in to try and achieve that, which is made you unable to actually achieve because you're trying to scratch the surface of a lot of things. You're not establishing the context. I definitely think that it should be planted and that it should be looked into again. Right, amendments to the OBE, we're very well aware of that, and we are so relieved to have a reduction from 8-9 with the languages down to 6 with regard to the intermediate phase. Little bit concerned that the concepts in technology, which are going to be included in science, will again increase the load in that subject because they would want all those concepts covered, those sophisticated and difficult concepts, and again will be probably introduced too early without sufficient time. With regard to comparison, at our school, we're actually a remedial school, and we have children come in for short time periods. They come in between 2 to 4 years because they have difficulties with learning, usually in the areas of language, and they really have strengths in the areas of math, but we are still struggling with the strengths they have in that area to accommodate all the concept skills and knowledge within the math curriculum. So we have comparisons with children in the mainstream schools in our area, no comparisons or experience sort of globally, no scientific investigation, I'm afraid not. We wish we could do more of that, but we are so busy teaching and trying to keep up with the workload in the curriculum. And with regard to, I mentioned the capacity was to develop worksheets and material, not necessarily interpret the curriculum and implement it into our lesson plans. We tend to talk too of worksheets. We would want country, works in disease, which is quite a new term. We don't feel they sufficiently handle the concepts and skills. And with regard to all the ideas are marvelous. I mean, I could have something on the website for teachers, parents, and children to use. But what we find is we are a well-resourced school, and that we even have to say we don't have time to even avail ourselves of some of the resources that we are available to us. And they're not always appropriate to what the students. We've got to start with the learner and what the learner needs. And from year to year, you will find that this group of children you've got changes, and you need to adapt what you are doing and how you're working with it. And depending on their level of difficulty, the assessment tasks require you to go across four or five classes and assess them on the same task to see where they fit in. And some of them are unable to do the task, and that they're projected to them is no varying level. And there are varying levels of ability and development and what they're capable of doing. And they actually tend to become so fearful that they won't attempt or think anymore. Maybe any other questions? Oh, well, we firmly believe that the chief minister workload is far too high, but that has been addressed in the past team recommendations and findings, so we're very pleased about that.
Perhaps in the last 3 minutes that are left, given that we don't often encounter remedial schools, you might want to just give us a sense of your school, what it does, at what point do you take kids out of the mainstream, take them through to remedial, and then back?
Yes. We start with a developmental unit where children are referred at a young age who are at risk for learning. We go from grade 1 to grade 7. The children in the old system, we use a medical model where they have to be assessed, their intellectual potential has to be assessed, and then they have to have a neurobiological inherent learning disability as a barrier to learning. And then they are removed from the mainstream and they attend school for 2-3, on average now we find 3 years, where we carry out the curriculum, have to keep up with that because they will be returning to mainstream, and we have to remediate, and we have therapies, they attend occupational therapy, speech and language therapy, and it's quite a demanding load, but and that's what's so important, because they come in with a very low self-concept and self-esteem because they have struggled to learn in the mainstream school. They also come in, we have a case discussion with the teachers from the mainstream school with our team, our multidisciplinary team and these teachers, and they will come in and say, you know, their maths is quite strong, and we will find out that they are not as strong as the teacher said they were, they are struggling with the concept, they don't retain them, they haven't had sufficient work on them to have a good foundation laid. And I think a lot of the problems we have, and this is a generalization, with math at high school level, start right down there in grade R now, because in grade R we have to do fractions, and they do not have the mental capacity to understand the fractional concept. And right up to grade 4 or 5, and you will introduce fractions, and they usually do it physically, and you'll say, well, what is their fraction? They'll say a half, because that's as far as they've got, as you say, saying two parts of a half. So if it would be quarters, eighths, 11th, whatever, they say half, because that's as far as they've got with their fraction.
And are you able to track your learners in terms of their success once they leave your school?
We have feedback from learners and parents. We do track it to a certain degree. We have learners come back and speak at our ceremony, and some have gone on to do extremely well.
Did Mashwana, you wanted to ask some questions?
Thank you, Peterson. And I want to thank you for the presentation. One important question that I get to ask was covered by my colleague, Honorable Makulin. It was about the fact that definitely there is change in the Lord way. Like the Lord has been lessened. The book has good perception. But then and I know that you clearly talk of concern. It concerns me, and of course it's clear that it's even tender concern. But it sometimes asks to come with solution. And I'm listening to your concerns, and I'm checking if we don't need a paradigm shift. Because, like, one of the concerns that really puzzled me is that there is too far more assessment. Actually, education is about assessment. It's assessment all the way. We cannot assess enough, that's my understanding. And we need to appreciate the good that is there, so that we are able to move together. Because it's not about the government moving separately, but it's like we depend on what is happening in schools, in your school, private school, public school, all of these schools need to work together. But my concern is that we need to definitely approach this with some paradigm shift in mind. Because a lot has been done to change the concept that has been appearing in. And one is wondering if any change would be recognized from this particular school. Thank you very much. And in conclusion, the many assessments that you're talking about, there should be threefold to make it maybe interesting. Self-assessment by the learner, peer assessment, I'm sure you know this.
Yes, in fact, because of the time constraints, I would have definitely included the positivity of the curriculum. I'm a firm believer in it. I think it's extremely good. I just think it's a time that we need to do it in. And I would think the amount of work, for example, you have to do in grade 3 or grade 4, if we had double the time to do it, you would have far more success with the learning. And it is positive, and it's definitely some very positive moves being made. Time constraints restricted all that, so I had to focus on the two areas of concern.
And you know, we definitely will have regard to your written submission when we do revisit that particular or when we get to that phase of the public hearing. So all of your concerns are being noted. As I said, you would just highlight the ones that are most significant to you. Thank you very, very much. Is there a final comment you want to make, given that we did steal a few minutes from your time?
No, it's fine. Thank you.
Thank you very much for coming, and thank you for your input. Could we go on to the next presentation, which is from the Chandler Wilder Success Book.
Good morning, thank you, Madam Chair, and thank you for inviting me. When I got the invitation last week, I was very surprised. I thought my submission would disappear into the great number of submissions, and when I put it in, I thought, well, maybe I'm just adding a little bit of weight to other people's ideas, and consequently, what I put in there has been covered, in fact, already by a lot of people. So I'll focus on the issues that haven't been mentioned so far, because an awful lot of what I would have to say has already been said. That's not necessarily to say that I would agree with it all, but there we are. The other thing, of course, is sitting here, we're closing a circle, and I'm very, very conscious of history, and I'm one of the few people here who's old enough to remember the outrage of my mother in 1954 when Bantu Education was launched. And so to sit here today, 56 years later, and say, gee, we're actually moving, it's quite emotional for me. And so I thank you for this opportunity from that point of view. The submission I made is fairly broad, and as I said, I'd like to focus on the more novel things that I put in. So I'll just go through the points very quickly, just so that they're on record, as it were, in terms of the identified challenges and priorities. Scientific language proficiency, which is the particular aspect I'm interested in as the director of the outreach program that I run, very concentrate on maths, but obviously literacy in general, but specifically scientific literacy, is a massive problem, and coupled with that is numeracy. The baseline tests, which have mostly been informal, but nevertheless they are baseline tests that we've done, have been quite scary. We teach grade 10, 11, 12 learners in our outreach school, and their learning level in terms of baseline numeracy may be probably instead of grade 10, 11, 12 level, is grade 6, 7, 8 level in terms of basic numeracy. And it's not just in the outreach environment that is a problem. I've taught A candidate math students who don't know that, for instance, 1 is to 10 is the same as dividing 1 is divided by 10. It's just a language thing. Going on to the second point, we also in that whole scene, I think we've maybe got our national priorities wrong as regards core maths and math literacy. And I must just point out there's an error here in my original submission in the last sentence where I said the number of learners has shifted from about 75 to 25% math to core maths. It should be the other way around. Math 75 to 25% maths core to maths lit. So I apologize for that error. And so there's been a movement by the learners attending our outreach school, and I remind you that they are there entirely voluntary, and we do not select at all. And if they turn up at our doors, we register. So there's been a movement there from that 75 to 25% maths core to more or less 50-50 core to lit. So they are voting with their feet against maths core. And if you actually do the maths, how many learners who are going to write grade 12 are actually going to need core maths in later life? And it's actually a very small proportion. And we are pushing far too many kids there with a net result that far too many, instead of passing well at maths lit, are failing badly at maths core. And I think that's probably one of the more important lessons that we've seen from what we've seen in our school. And I think at this point I need to point out that I'm at an advantage in some ways. We have 2,200 learners registered with us, and we come from over 200 schools in Gauteng. And so that's the advantage I have. The disadvantage that I have is that I don't see them in the township schools on a day-to-day basis. I don't wake up with them on a winter's morning in a shack. I don't see the other challenges firsthand that are facing them, and who can ever understand what it's like if you're not growing up in that environment. So what I'm seeing is what they are reporting to us, either directly or by implication of what's happening in their schools. And one of the big things that they point out to us is the lack of confidence in their teachers. I had a bunch, end of 2008, a bunch of kids came to me and said they had not been taught any chemistry. This was 3 months before they wrote their grade 12 exams. Not been taught any chemistry because the teacher said he doesn't do chemistry. And presumably if you've done a BSc degree, you've at least done chemistry at first year level. We then also get quite a lot of social issues going on, point four in my submission. Quite a lot of social issues as far as safety, those kind of things. We've had to deal with the rape cases. One child was in tears last week, her brother had just been murdered, these kind of things. Again, it's not our first time experience, but these are issues obviously that are in the social background of delivering education in South Africa that we need to be aware of. I think one of the big issues, going back to the literacy issue, is that it's often reported to us by my tutors. I have 25 tutors and 25 professional teachers teaching these kids, and that the tutors often come back to me and say, you know, this kid understands what I'm teaching him, but they're only getting 30% for their exam. And then you quiz the learner, and they will say, well, yeah, I'm fine, I understand it, but I don't understand the exam. And that's quite a big issue. That it is just a literacy issue, which of course is one lit. Maths lit is much more language heavy than maths core. A lot of kids will choose maths core for that reason. Then getting on to the access to resources, I think a lot has already been said about access to libraries. But I used the phrase in my original report that very few schools have functioning libraries, it's nothing short of a national disgrace. And I think that illustrates so many things. And just to incorporate into the idea of school libraries, of course, is the idea of technology. If you look at schools and say, well, the schools that have got functioning libraries and functioning technology are successful, therefore, if we put libraries and functioning technology into schools, they will be successful too. And that's a bit of a red-headed hearing, but it's not a cause and effect situation. The schools that have got functioning libraries and functioning technologies have got those things because they are functioning well in other ways. It's a great mistake to think that putting technology into a school is going to change that school. I've seen schools all over South Africa where, in fact, sponsors have donated technology, but they haven't donated training, they haven't donated support, and very often that technology hasn't even been unpacked, literally sitting in the school's strong room because nobody knows how to work it, and yet they are ticked off in some way or another by somebody either in government or in a corporate donor situation to having put computers, whatever, into those schools. Then going further on to looking at the whole access to resources thing, that impact on the way that these things are used. So for example, children have got to do projects and fieldwork and these kind of things. And I had one child come to me at the beginning of this year saying he had been asked, this is a great thing, been asked to make a weather instrument, and what should he do? And he brought out a whole lot of diagrams, a very sophisticated weather instrument. He didn't understand the technology that went into those weather instruments, but he was going to make a cardboard cutout that looked the same. And I've seen that repeated. I've seen kids running around in Limpopo province with boxes cut out to look like TV. These are school projects. And you ask, what's the point? They don't learn anything about TV. Their hands get sore trying to cut cardboard with blunt scissors, and that's about all they learn about it. We've really got to get the understanding in the teaching profession as to why they're doing stuff. What is the purpose of field work? What is the purpose of practical exercise and laboratory work and so on? And the only way that, of course, is, and to support my colleagues who said, is go back to teacher training and make sure those teachers who are doing laboratory work and field work and some have actually done it themselves, because that's where the confidence comes from that I talk about elsewhere, is the lack of confidence. And then looking at learning and support social structures, if you follow me in my original presentation on number 9, learning and support social structures, many successful schools and divide their schools into the British model, I guess, which is of houses and then tutor groups and so on. These are vertical structures. One of the mistakes of, I guess, is Western education and perhaps Anglophone education is that we divide our schools horizontally. And if you've got a school of 1,500 kids, that's 300 kids to a grade, and they are all competing horizontally, and they're not learning from these learners above them, they're not mentoring the learners below them. It creates all sorts of social problems, and of course you are assuming that everybody in a age cohort is at the same level educationally, and it just doesn't work. So the more you can divide your school vertically, I'm not saying it's abandon the grade system, but the more vertical structures there are, the more vertical mentoring that happens, and that's as much part of discipline as it is of anything else. So if your matric kids see a grade 8 misbehaving in some way, although the matrics might be behaving the same way, they would view it as a matric privilege, and they'll make sure the grade 8 don't do that kind of thing. There's not enough vertical mentoring. And that, I would suggest, and we started to implement this in our Saturday school, is that we need to mentor vertically. So I employ university students as academic mentors, but what's happening, of course, is that they start to establish personal relationships busy, they're too deep, and all sorts of other issues come out. And so what we're looking at now, and starting to implement this, and many other schools do this, of course, as a matter of course, is that I want to require the grade 10, 11, 12 learners who are benefiting by coming to us, and they don't pay anything, they come there voluntary, but to make it a requirement of them being there, that they actually mentor grade 7, 8, and 9 learners. And it just makes sense that once you start doing that, if a grade 9 pupil is teaching little brother or sister or their friends to count, that has to have a benefit. And the benefit is not just downwards, it's also upwards, because the only way to learn is to teach, the only real way. And I would perhaps then just highlight that if we think about what were the great lessons that we had at school, and I'm prepared to venture that every single one of you who had a great lesson involved you at the centre, not the teacher. And think about too the one or two lessons that you remember that you thoroughly enjoyed. It wasn't something the teacher did, it was something the teacher allowed you to do. And if that didn't happen to you, then I think you've probably been in a lousy school and missed out. But anyway, and then going on from that mentoring and the whole system of houses and tutors, that of course then gets to parents and the role they play, and we've already heard from a previous presentation how important that can be, so I won't say anything more about that. And then there's other things like what are the students' ambitions, these kind of things, the whole career counselling scene. If I was to ask, and I haven't actually done this, but I'm pretty sure it would be true, if I was to take the 2,000 kids who come to our Saturday school and say, what is your career ambition? And bearing in mind that we bill ourselves as a maths and science academy, the vast majority would say doctoral engineer. It's one of the things we do is take them on job shadow experiences into all sorts of different things. And these are aha moments when they see, for instance, a call centre operating and the whole functioning of, say, the insurance industry, whatever it is. It's absolutely eye-opening for these kids. And it just increases their possibilities, their hope. I think the one business that I really am in is, and all my professional colleagues, is that we're in the business of hope. And if we have the confidence in what we're doing and we can impart that confidence to the kids, then we really are making progress. So the recommendations that I've put out here, and some of them I'll just skip over, a massive national literacy and numeracy program, and that needs to start at grade 0 level, just about. But of course, the predictor of school academic achievement is parental educational achievement. So that has to go hand in hand with an AVID program to make sure that one of the previous presenters said that there are countries that have achieved national literacy in a very short space of time, and Cuba and I think Korea being two very good examples of that. Then the mentoring thing, I think, should be compulsory. If you've had the privilege to be allowed to go to university, and for a relatively small number of people, you should have the duty to mentor, and that goes all the way down. Grade 12 is mentoring, and we've talked about that already. And then there's the new technology, the new communication, cell phone technology. We are busy having a very careful look. Almost all the children who come from very disadvantaged backgrounds to our school, almost all of them have cell phones, even if they're very basic. And the opportunity there are ways of distributing short stories, of asking questions where the children get a question and a multiple choice answer that can be sent back and then automatically monitored and that kind of thing. All this kind of thing creates enthusiasm. The technology doesn't necessarily improve learner performance. And in fact, no real evidence that all the technology we put in schools makes any difference at all to learner performance, but it does make a difference to their ability to function in the context of the society that they're going into. So, and the enthusiasm with which they do. So if we are monitoring kids via cell phones all the time, they're far less likely to be doing other things. If they know that there's a tutor at the end of a cell phone they can ask a question to, they can instantly get feedback on that kind of thing. My next point there about girl child safety, I think I'm not an expert on that other than to say that this is a problem we've recognised in our schools. And then point 7, I think, is one of the important recommendations. We also work fairly closely with Penrhyn College in Mpumalanga Lowveld. And one of the models that I developed there along with their director is what we call a community learning, the community, a learning community idea. And the idea here is that centered on a high school, you create a learning community of schools where the creches that feed into the primary schools, that feed into the middle schools, that feed into the high schools, be viewed as a unit. And this has not only the sort of expectation advantage, if you know your kid's going into the bottom, they're going to come out of the top of a great high school at the end, but also in shared resources. One of the communities I've worked with is Philippopolis in the Free State a few years ago. I've visited there on a regular basis for 3 or 4 years. And it just struck me that there is an old Model C school, and there are two township primary schools, there was another two primary schools. The old Model C school has an athletics track, a swimming pool, tennis courts, none of which are functioning. There was one library in the town that was functioning at any level. That was in one of the primary schools, which was supported largely by the wives of the local commercial farmers. Just struck me that in a community like that, one computer technician, one highly trained librarian, and say one professional sports coach would make all the difference to all 5 or 6 schools in that community. And so we've looked at implementing this in the Penreach School and in Mpumalanga outreach project that we're involved with. And we started to do that where there is mentoring of the headmaster by a retired headmaster. And we're looking now at implementing house systems in those schools. Initially a lot of resistance because we're talking about state schools that are unionized and so on. But once they've got over that initial hump of seeing house systems and tutors and inter-house competitions and debates and all of those things, that are the things that motivate kids, get them wanting to be at school. Those impact. I think that's the real reason why a lot of our schools are highly successful, because the peripheral enthusiastic things that make kids want to be at school are so successful. I don't think I should stop there. Thank you, Madam Chair.
Thank you very much. We unfortunately just have about 5 minutes. So members, in posting your questions, be very brief. Let me see here. Mr. Lorimer, Dr. Flopsis Lawrence, Mr. Michon, in that order.
Mr. Gere, is it, you talk about kids coming to
you, Mr. Lorimer. Let me just welcome our guests in the gallery. I see that you all have lovely school uniforms, which means that you are at a nice school. And this is the Portfolio Committee on Basic Education, and this chamber that you are in now is a very historic chamber. You will find one just like it in London, in the British House of Commons. And it's almost the same, and it's made out of exactly the same wood. And it's made out of South African wood. So I hope you all enjoy your visit to Parliament, and I hope you learn a lot of things about Parliament, and I hope that you're all going to pass very well at the end of the year. I take it you all enjoy school? Oh, I'm getting a bit worried that you don't sound so enthusiastic, but I think now that I look carefully, I can see that you're all smiling and you're all happy. So work hard and pass well, okay? Enjoy it, bye-bye. So, Mr. Lima, please continue.
Thanks, Chair. You talk about the low levels of baseline knowledge that these kids come to you. Do you find it possible to fix this in the limited time that's available to you? And related to that, are there prospects of rolling out your model more widely?
The difference between maths core and maths lit. I'm of the view that maths literacy is a very unfortunate name for that subject. It is not maths at all. It creates a lot of confusion when it comes to subject choices, specifically with parents and learners. This subject should be, according to my views, be a compulsory subject for all learners. What are your views on this?
Thank you, Tabitha. I'm checking if Brother wants to ask a question on number 6. It's about single sex middle school. But I want to check the letters that are here. Is it single sex school? Is it? Yeah, they look like. They are boys. They are boys, and so I thought it's. I thought it's single because I wanted to reserve my question. But then I continue. I thank you, Chairperson, again. And thank you for the presentation. I think it's very good. And your concern about girl child is very important. But then we need to grow up together. Such that much as we understand that girls need to be safe, if they have their own school, they may be socially destroyed for life. So I would propose that we don't talk of single gender schools if possible, if it's okay with you. Otherwise, I think we're coming with things that will take this country forward. Thank you.
Let me just pose a few questions here about some of the issues that may have been canvassed already. Let me just ask you, you know, with this math literacy thing, which is now being raised by Dr. Tosculin, there's a perception out there that math literacy, on the one hand, you think, you know, math score is a bit too high a standard and really wouldn't meet the needs of most students and so on, because not everybody is going to book, you know, going to university, become an engineer, etc. But would you say that math literacy is far too light in content on the other hand? Or would you say that it's quite a good medium? Because for me, you know, a good medium is really what we should be striving for with regard to math. Then I think the other thing that I want to raise with regard to the issue of safety, I'm very interested in this issue of disruption, simply because the one area that certain studies have come out which seems to indicate that the Western Cape is really the heart of gang-related activities, drug abuse. So in fact, on Monday I met with a bunch of school governing body chairpersons on the Cape Flats, and each one of these individuals raised the issue of drug abuse in their schools. We can't ever look at housing as perhaps synonymous with the extent of gang-related activities and drug abuse. Could you give me a sense from your experience of the schools, you know, how many schools participate in your program? I have got no sense of that. You say, you know, you've got a number of them, but exactly how many schools actually participate in that? Do they all come from a particular area, or are they from across the board? You know, the fact that you raise this as one of your key considerations, key problems, gives me an indication that you think it's far more widespread than perhaps the usual perception goes. So that's something that I do want you to contextualize for us. And then you raise the issue of the resources not being able to be accessible because either fears of audits not being complied with, or in fact people not being able to use computers and other resources at their disposal. I want to invite you to please to communicate with us about specific instances that you find in your work related activities, so that, you know, these things can't just be left unchallenged. I do think that this is a major problem, and particularly when it comes to textbooks. I mean, I can't imagine what people are thinking if they keep their textbooks locked up in safe. It just doesn't make any sense to me. So please, I do want to invite you, even if you want to do it confidentially and so on, to please communicate with Mr. Brown in writing to just indicate where you encounter these problems so that we can certainly, as part of our oversight activity, look into such difficulties. Over to you, sir.
Thank you, Madam Chair. And just to come to your first question, in terms of the number of schools and our involvement, because I think that needs comfort. We have got 2,200 children registered. They can't attend every Saturday. We teach 27 Saturdays a year. And the ones that can't attend every Saturday almost exclusively for financial reasons. And they come from, at the last count, 212 schools from Gauteng and immediately beyond, some from Northwest and some from Mpumalanga. So they are travelling up to 150 kilometres to get to us. In Gauteng, more or less evenly distributed between Soweto and Orange Farm and Tembisa Ivory Park, Deep Stuart Cosmo area, and then the Greater Johannesburg area. We get quite a lot of kids coming from Model C schools that are viewed as good schools, as well as considerable number, the vast majority are township kids. And we even have a few learners coming from independent schools. So we do cover a broad spectrum, and they are exclusively for one school. Back in the day, and people think it's advantaged in terms of the kind of kids that are joining us. To get back to the specific questions, baseline tests, we've done them informally so far. We are moving towards a computer generated baseline test, which will then automatically be monitored, and we will require the children to repeatedly, 3 or 4 times a year, do the baseline so that we can track longitudinally how we're doing. You ask the question, are we making a difference? It's one of the most unbelievably difficult things to prove that you're making a difference. I've been involved with the Penryn program in the Lowveld since its inception nearly 20 years ago, and the donors keep asking that question, are you making a difference? And we are absolutely sure we're making a difference, but it's very difficult to prove in terms of results because of the accessibility to results is difficult. But certainly anecdotally, the feedback we get from the kids' school reports, and those are inconsistent in their reliability, that means that we are making a difference in that respect. Is there an opportunity for rollout? Well, we are based in an independent school. There's nothing to stop any other independent school opening its doors on Saturday to school kids and employing university students. Obviously, in those areas where there are no universities, it's a bit more difficult. But we also have a substantial number of volunteers. We've got 25 professional staff, 25 tutors, and about the same number of corporate volunteers. So in areas where there isn't a university, I'm sure you can find corporate volunteers that come. All sorts of people, when they hear what we're doing, they just phone me up and say, can they come and teach? And it's not necessarily teaching. It may be mentoring in just making sure they get there kind of way. So roll out, yes, absolutely. Then the questions about Maths Core versus Maths Litton, if I may put them together. The general experience with Maths Core I'm a maths teacher, but not a practicing maths teacher. My practicing maths teacher colleagues will tell me that Maths Core is quite difficult. And certainly it's valuable. If you're going into any of the sciences, yes, you must do Maths Core. If you're doing anything else, then, and obviously if I'm passing Maths Core, let's put a benchmark on it. You've obviously got to pass Maths Core at 50% at least to make it useful in the sciences. If you're getting less than 50% in Maths Core at school, it's highly unlikely you're going to be a successful science student, assuming you're working, of course. So if we benchmarked it and said, right, anyone who's getting less than 60% in Maths Core should seriously consider doing Maths Literacy unless they really, really, really think that they can get there and improve themselves, then I would say go for Maths Literacy. We get so many kids who just aren't cutting the grade in Maths Core, who I know, generally at the lower end, put it this way, at the lower end, but if you're getting 40% in Maths Core, you can pretty much bet you would get at least 60% in Maths Lit. Not because Maths Lit is light or too easy or anything, but it's much more practical and relevant and meaningful. The big difficulty, as I mentioned earlier, with Maths Lit is it's language loaded, and that does create big difficulties. I don't think it's nice. I think I would agree with your suggestion that maybe it should be compulsory. There is not enough practical maths component in the maths core, but then that's not what maths core is about. So perhaps a lot of that maths list stuff should be done prior to grade 10 so that everyone's got it, because it is useful. I mean, just filling in your tax form or doing your local accounts as a street vendor may be useful. Coming to the question of single-sex schools, I do qualify in my submission that in some instances where girl child safety is an issue, and then there are models that are beyond the simple single-sex, the school that I teach at St. Vivian's College, which where Tantawani is based, actually has a model where we have single-gender schools on one campus, so we get the best of both worlds, and that's the model that needs to be pursued further. Then the issues of gang-related, perhaps gang is a bit too strong a word, but the only disciplinary issue that I've had with the children coming to us on our campus from all these different schools is the issue of drug-related things. If you've had to stop people and say, look, if you're going to come here smelling of dapper or whatever, then you're not going to come here. And when we talk to the kids about it, they repeatedly tell us that it's pervasive. Perhaps not in the same structured gangway of the Western Cape, with all the territorial stuff that goes on with that, but certainly it's an issue. And the fact that I have to deal with it as director of Tandrawazi, where we've got good kids volunteering to be there, these are great kids, we never have to say a word of discipline in class, they come, they want to learn, and it's an issue with them. And you can imagine what it's like in the thousands of kids who are not coming to us, who aren't as committed to their learning. So yes, it is anecdotal, but I think it's out there. What we do every year is we get a learner feedback, which we do in August. We're about to just participate in that now that we've got the June exam results. And we only ask the kids who've been with us for 2 years or more to answer the learner feedback, because we want some linear component to it. And in fact, we considered this year asking them to be specific about the issues that are facing the school. Now, we've had this sense, I've seen it personally in schools in the Free State, in rural KwaZulu-Natal, in rural Eastern Cape, in going back a while now to probably 15 years ago, I've seen it in Northwest in the Rustenburg area, and I've seen with my own eyes piles and piles and piles of textbooks locked in schoolrooms, and the last, and I haven't been on those kind of trips too recently, but within the last 2 years I have seen in several places around the country school schoolrooms with computers, with school textbooks locked away full of plastic wrappers. And last week I asked a group of grade 12 why they didn't have any geography textbooks. No, they haven't been issued. And that was a class of about 20 kids representing maybe 5 or 6 different schools. And university, they said, no, they haven't got geography textbooks. So it is an issue, and I'm going to ask in my learner feedback form, when I issue you next week, that specific question, so I will be able to feedback. Thank you.
Thank you so much, Mr. Gain. Thank you for participating in these hearings. May I convey my best wishes to you and your staff and wish you all strength going forward. We next go on to Base Education 161, which is Math Center Incorporating Services. Ms. Shah, Ms. Shah. It's S-H-A-N, yes. Is it Shah? Please, you have 10 minutes, your presentation, and then we'll interact with you. What an absolute pleasure it is to be here. I'm trying to make a PowerPoint presentation. Can I? Okay, thank you. Mathematics Center is a very large organization. 29 donors fund some 27 projects, which are from 3 to 5 years duration,
It's a level 1B compliant provider, 25 years old, early next year. Currently, there are 16 high school projects and 11 primary, and the expanded portfolio includes engineering skills development and entrepreneurship education. We truly do believe that young children, and we have found this from our experience, totally love technology. We have developed our own software, and I have brought 5 CDs to give to colleagues if they are interested. Children as young as 3 to 5 year olds can interact with computer-generated mathematics and physical science understanding and gain tremendous advantages and delight from it. We, for each project, we have a very, very intellectually rigorous turnaround strategy, which is deeply rooted into cumulative gaps, which I'll talk about in a minute. The center is in 9 provinces, so there are 9 centers. In the Western Cape, where we are at the moment, we have a partnership with the department in 250 primary schools. Antoinette, my colleague, is sitting next to me in charge of 10 field trainers who work in every single part of the Western Cape. It's an 8-year project that would eventually cover all primary schools. The ideas hub, the ideas are conceptualized, generated, rigorously tested. Impact assessments are absolutely at the heart of it, and I'll give you some results in a minute. And those are some of the 29 donors reflected on the screen throughout the country, as you can see. Obviously, they change. Most projects are 3 to 5 year duration, and they are in pure mathematics, physical science, mathematical literacy, technology, and entrepreneurship education. Just some glimpses of the Math Center, where we have a lab for each subject. Locally, learners come in all the provinces in order to learn and participate using materials. Textbooks, as colleagues have already said, we supply a lot of materials. Something like 50 million rand worth department-approved materials have been supplied to some 1,500 schools throughout the country. What drives me? I come from England. I was an Office for Standards in Education inspector some 17 years ago. I have worked in 8 countries, traveled to many. Mathematics, physics, chemistry are an absolute passion. I came here in 1995, very humble beginnings, homelessness at one point. Therefore, plight of children is always top in my mind. The last 18 of the 31 years in England, I worked with African Caribbean children and began to realize that for all sorts of complex reasons, Black African children seem to be falling behind, and perhaps it was time one focused one's life. I was very lucky to be invited to come and work here. What drives the Math Center? 68 staff, 59 of whom are young Black Africans with degrees in mathematics, physics, and science, and largely they are hungry to make a change in our country. We want to improve teacher qualifications, competencies, and professionalism. So far, we have added over 1,200 qualified teachers, partnering with Nelson Mandela University, Stellenbosch University, Wits University, to the pool of qualified teachers in our country. As far as learners are concerned, we don't compromise. We want to produce mathematically, scientifically literate learners. Therefore, we do work directly with learners a lot. Our strategy comes from the national MSD strategy, National Strategy for Learner Attainment, added to which is our own unique brand of understanding of quality of teaching and learning and how children learn and why they fail. That is our essential model. I'll be more than happy to send this presentation to colleagues in the room. It's a logic model based on objectives, outcomes, indicators, assessments, and understanding of the impact. Those 7 or 8 are the key factors why children in our country are failing mathematics and physics. Teachers do not cover the curriculum. Their pace is very slow. We do test them very formally, and we produce formal reports on our teachers and our learners. 80 to 85% of the time within FET, teachers are found to be either below or just above the level of the children, which is broadly speaking performance below 60%. The problem with that is that they cannot proceed to abstract methods of learning and solving problems regardless of whether it's pure mathematics, physics, or mathematical literacy. Their expectation, the cognitive demand of children is very low. In mathematics and in physics, four things are key: reading, writing, drawings, and representation. In our classrooms, we are lucky if we find even 10% of that going on. We set up information technology centers supported by donors, and there are two companies, Mathematics Ace and EduKite, who have produced special interactive ware which the learners can interact with, and they truly, I'll show you in a second, they do produce better results because technology is their world. Everything around them is technology. A young 15-year-old can be on a cell phone for a whole day. I have absolutely no idea how or why, but they seem to be able to tremendously tune into technology. Those are our monitoring tools and impact assessments for all the learners. They are pre-tested, post-tested. Performance is then compared with systemic tests that are going on, whether it's Gauteng or Western Cape or Northwest or Limpopo. All children are encouraged to have their own record of achievement. Teachers are tested and transfer of learning is evaluated. The diagram on the screen then is the key to the model, that's the math center model. At every single step, the spiral tells you the gaps that are being built, both for the teachers and the learners. When they actually come to grade 7, already the gaps are so big that they cannot touch the current curriculum without first understanding, correcting the cumulative gaps. Just on the gaps, I just want to go to one slide, which is a little bit later, in terms of what happens is this. In four areas of mathematics and physics, children struggle. In terms of understanding the curriculum, the learner outcomes, specific areas of concern, children don't know what is my difficulty, can I do fractions, can I do ratios, if I can't, why I can't. Teachers are not able to build on those errors. Then the actual cognitive levels of learning and understanding at various levels, non-existent. Language, a very big issue in our classroom. And then difficulty. Those four are just tiny examples. We tested 15,000 learners, and as you can see, 95% at grade 11 could not do ratios. 98% of the learners at grade 11 could not draw a correct, accurate equation of a straight line. You've got data there from four provinces, which is just a glimpse. This was, we have our own test developed by University of Pretoria, both in mathematics and physics, and all the items are always analyzed so that we can support the learners properly. So what am I saying? What I'm trying to say is that success is possible, and you see it there, an example. HSRC evaluation is available to verify this. Under Professor Gardner Arsenal's tenure, we had a very large 40 million rand project in 500 high schools throughout the country, and you can see the progress made. The bad side, moment the math center left, a large number of those 500 schools lost the momentum. And that is also happening in dinner lady schools. Last year, in a project where 400 learners, top learners, gained 103 distinctions, it was totally a learner-focused project. The bad side, we couldn't really work with teachers because the gaps were so big. So there are risks, and there are tremendous advantages in the model, but the risks are more to do with the fact that as an NGO, we really have to beg and plead for funding and beg and plead with departments to work with us. Yes, they do, and they do very successfully, but sadly, in the absence of an inset model in our country, we are a very poor relation of the department and not someone to be proud of to partner with. Those are some of the reasons where success happens. Teachers consider it personal empowerment. There is huge communication between the department and my trainers. Attendance at workshops is great. Planning is brilliant. Audio-visual aids, workshop manuals, performance appraisals, parental involvement, all those things work very well. And that's a glimpse. Children love mathematics when they understand it. Mathematics is the language of the universe. So, yes, when it works beautifully. Risk, as I've already mentioned a few, constantly a large number of learners do not get to the 50% baseline required. The result of that is this. Currently, in our system, in our country, quarter of our population is in school. 1 million learners enter the system each year. The total is 12.4. Last year's matric graph, I'm very happy to send them to you, I'm sure you do have them, only 338,000 learners gained a matric pass in mathematics, physical science, and so on. One has to ask what happens to the others, 700,000. Wonderful question about mathematics, literacy, and math score, ma'am. What we have now done is we've begun a major project with Masita throughout the country where these 80% of young children will study mathematical literacy. You see, the thing to understand is that in order to get an opportunity to go to SET colleges, and Dr. Nazimande and our organization, we've had some conversations, children require mathematical literacy at level 7 and level 6 and level 5. That's a very high level, and our teachers are not able to reach. That means getting into SET colleges and artisans academies is also a very big problem. And that is why one ends up with 66.9% young people coming out of schools with not a certificate to their name. Extremely sad story, as I'm sure you would agree. To conclude then, please, technology, behave. Do not do this to a senior person. Do it to a young person. Okie dokie, here we go. So what am I offering as solutions? This is what I would like to see with the National Department of Education. Immediately, those short-term solutions can be put into place. I promise you, we are a 25 million rand a year organization, and if we can have numbers like that, I'm sure with more funding, more training, more partnerships that are constructive, one can go very far. Currently, we have 254 primary schools, 327 high schools, 124,000 learners, primary, 92,000 high, 2,886 primary educators, and 1,400 high school educators. Some are engaged in degree studies, some are engaged in aid studies, and some are obviously not. So, this short-term solution that I'm proposing, this requires to be done with all the kids in math, science, and technology, and so on. Very quickly, examination preparedness, division plans, calculator provision. We have brought some materials for you, and we'll be very happy to leave them for you to examine them in your own time. Use of textbooks, conducting winter schools, conducting after-school clinics, conducting Saturday classes. We'll be very happy to engage in that partnership. This comes from my own experience of being in education of mathematics and physics for some 44 years. Every single teacher must do either a 20 or a 30 or a 40 day. We've just begun to do that with Barbara Creasy through the Sardona Center in Gauteng, and we hope to do that throughout the country. Teacher buddies, support teachers, mentoring systems, graduate teachers, going into schools, university volunteers, and so on. Long term, which is your domain, those 8 levels truly need to be examined in great detail as to what's going wrong and what's happening. those are some of the things that we are offering in terms of strategy, in terms of how learners learn. As I said, mathematics and physics are very hardcore areas, drawing, reading, writing, and talk. And children love doing it when they engage in it, I promise you, and the success speaks for itself. Within mathematics and physics, unless you understand in terms of the language in the mind, the reasoning, the proof, making connections, representing, problem solving, it's not going to happen. And I've spoken about that already. Some of the other risks are my appeal to you, my intense appeal to you in my autumn years is please recognize all the partners in this room, all the NGOs in our country, bring us together and we will support you for not only putting forward fantastic models, but also raise funding. I happen to have 29 donors who've been supporting us since the day I arrived. Thank you very much.
Thank you very much. We don't have too much of time, again, members. Very short and pithy questions. Dr. Flockers-Lawrence? Only Dr. Flockers-Lawrence? Okay.
Probably very short. You mentioned that language is a huge problem. What is your solution to the language problem?
Okay. Sorry.
All your questions, Dr. Flockers-Lawrence? Okay. You know, I've been reading your documents that you sent through, and one of the reasons we actually asked you to come to this is because I'm not quite clear what you actually do. After all what you said. In the sense that I get a sense that you've got a center concept. Do you actually require kids to come to your center, or are you actually school-based? And for that, is that why you need your provincial education department to partner with you? If so, how does that actually happen? In other words, what happens in the morning when you get to school? Do you actually provide teachers for that school? Just provide teacher development, and affect change through actually training teachers and perhaps increasing their skills and knowledge, etc. How does that actually work? What is the, perhaps sort of just asking, what is the methodology you employ? And then, in terms of your success rate, how do you measure that? Do you just measure it in terms of students' passes, or do you actually assess teachers if that's the conduit that you use?
Okay, shall I answer it now? Okay. First, your question, ma'am. Can you just repeat the question so that I get it totally clear?
You mentioned that language is a huge problem.
And
what is your solution to
the solution? Okay. In terms of language for mathematics, we, in the first 10 years, did try to give children special English language lessons. Part of the Marathon Professor Father Altman's project was actually mathematics and English language. What happened was, yes, there was success, but the English language had nothing to do with when research was done and testing was done. There was no correlation that HSRC discovered for us. And I began to realize that what we need to do is take a very clear, deep, detailed, wide look at the mathematical language and the language of physics. And we use dictionaries in our kit. Definitions are 100% crucial from grade 4. Children need to understand that a circle is a circle because this is a contested terrain, this is its definition, and therefore a circle cannot be defined in any other way. A triangle cannot be. Those definitions need to be learned, much as you would learn in a language certain rules of the language. There are rules of mathematical language, whether it's in Afrikaans or if it is in English or if it is in Zulu or whatever, one needs to understand the precise meaning. It's a very detailed process. For grade 1, 2, and 3, we translate all our books and materials. But from grade 4 onwards, everything is in English or translated in Afrikaans if it is in the Northern Cape or people request it and so on. That is our current method, but we are a learning organization. If we find something else would work, we would of course run with it. Does that? Okay, thank you.
Let me ask, when we talk about language in South Africa,
yes, ma'am.
We have a particular difficulty. Given that we have 11 official languages and probably many other dialects in between. Now, when you say that you pay attention to definitions of context, I take it that you're using each of the official languages.
We use English plus whatever language as is learning for support, language for learning support, not as a main language, no. So, for example, if you need to define a straight line, the shortest distance between two points. Now that can easily be translated into any language, but constantly you engage with the child through reading and writing and discussion so that their English language is improved, because the purpose is to improve the language in which they are going to do their systemic test for the country. At grade 3, 6, 9, and 12, the tests are all in English or in Afrikaans.
Let me put it this way, and maybe I'm losing you because I'm not an educationist, right?
Okay.
And you can see from my questions that I'm not. I'm made to understand by people who are educationists,
yes,
that mother tongue language is very vital, yes, towards entrenching competence. In other words, a kind of conceptual development, a cognitive development,
yes,
that absolutely needs to happen. It's the stuff that we heard from Livingston School about having those foundational issues sorted out. Now that, I'm told, is facilitated by mother tongue. Now what you're doing, if I'm correct, you are using English and engaging individual children to actually establish those concepts, but at the same time, not necessarily using mother tongue.
Absolutely.
And how do you, does that mean, to somebody like me, does that negate the contention that it takes mother tongue to establish those concepts?
Okay, in terms of, you see, what are we defining as mother tongue? Many of children in our schools are coming in multilingual. Yes, in our rural areas, there are many children who at grade 1 would come in speaking Setswana or Venda or Zulu or whatever they may be. At that point, what you've just said is 100% correct. It's a question of balance. It's a contention between what they have to learn, what the formal curriculum prescribes that they have to learn. National Curriculum Statement in Mathematics and Physics, beyond grade 3, it is not translated into the 11 official languages. We assume by that, as well as systemic tests that children sit, that from grade 4 children are expected to learn mathematics and natural sciences and later physical sciences and technology in English. So for grades 1, 2, and 3, one attempts to use the mother tongue if it is available in correctness and accuracy. Many, many times these children's mother tongue is very poor also, in terms of writing particularly. Yes, they can speak it, but the expressions are quite poor. So one is mindful of the fact that ultimately you need to conceptualize, cognitively understand your mathematics in English, but you use the translation capacity to learn that as fast as you possibly can. But ultimately, from grade 4 onwards, you have to know it in English. That is my understanding of the situation in our country. But language is a very contentious issue in South Africa, as I understand it. Sorry. As we understand it from the provincial departments of education.
Yes.
I can't help you there. I think you need to press the button.
Just a matter of clarification.
Yes.
In the systemic evaluation,
yes,
is conducted in the language of learning of the school.
Yes.
So if the school does mathematics,
yes,
in English in grade 6,
yes,
that's what we provide the test in.
Yes.
So there's no position in the department to have those.
So if they are doing mathematics in Zulu in grade 6, then you would provide with systemic testing. I was not aware of that, because we've not come across that. That's fine. May I answer your question? Okay. The model of the Math Center in terms of how we work is, it's a donor-funded organization, point number one. A donor would choose 10 schools, 20 schools, a location, whatever, and would say, dear Sean, I've got 1.5 million rand per year to give you for 3 years, and our communities, take Ashton, for example, and what's the name of the power station in Lapalale, where they have just Madupi power station. So that's the first approach. Our model then, absolutely, it's non-negotiable that we will first go to the district, and we would say, those schools that the donor or the community, we would need to find 10 to 15 semi-functional schools. Then we will go to the district officer who would help us to choose the school, because our model is workshops, which is after school, class visits, 2 to 3 a week per school, 2 to 3 workshops per school, and then afternoon clinics for the learners, every Saturday classes for the learners, between 20 to 24 Saturdays per year, because one doesn't want to, you know, absolutely overload the kids. And in terms of then, how do we start? How do we know the baseline? We test the teachers and we produce a report. We test the learners, pre-test. They're very formal tests put together using thousands of rands by University of Pretoria in partnership with us. And we have an analysis that we do and a report that we write and present it to school. And then we say, these are the gaps that are holding back the teachers and the learners. So if it's a primary school and the teachers are not able to do number bonds very happily or place values very happily, those would be fundamental concepts. Because if you can't get a grasp on some of those, you will suffer later. And we will present a plan. And then we will say, these are the visits on these days. There is one full-time field trainer to every set of 10 schools. They are not based in school. They are based at the centers in different provinces. Then at the end of the term, we do a teacher progression analysis and a learner progression analysis. And a report is submitted to the department and to the donor. In terms of how we assess our success, obviously it is through monitoring mechanisms, and there are many. And one of those mechanisms is to see, say for example, last year, a particular school in the city of Joburg or here in Western Cape on the Gang Flats or whatever, was not getting kids to achieve even 50%. Because for me, I'm talking now as the CEO, as the director, unless the child can get to 50% by the time they're grade 5, they're not going to succeed very far. So we aim to correct that. So success is by glancing, by taking a glimpse of different projects, and seeing in how many projects in the learner progression representation are the children achieving above 50% in the primary. Same in the high school, as fast as possible, we need to get kids to get 50%. That's your level 5 onwards, in order to give them the level 4 onwards, in order to give them a chance to succeed. And it's those kind of research figures. We have an action research unit, and they present reports to me on each project from time to time, that I will assess the impact, not only what's going on in the schools with the teachers and the learners, but also, is this intervention working? Or are people just passing the time? So teaching is not about passing the time, it's a commitment. Does that make sense? Okay, thank you.
Okay. And thank you for your participation. There are a whole lot of things that hopefully we will recommend, but one of the things in the Master's Mystery Tradition in Leeds was the proposal that we actually recommend to the department to have a platform where NGOs can come and showcase what they're doing and perhaps, you know, in your case, even come and refine some of the things as you develop further into your projects and so on. So hopefully we get to that point with the department. I know that one of your concerns is how the department is actually related to NGOs. Yes. So thank you all for coming today and participating. It's been a very interesting and dynamic session. We will, as I say, try and get copies of the report out to all of you who participated. If we haven't got your email address, please make sure that you don't leave here without Mr. Brown having a certain address, but I do know that we have most of your email addresses. Members, tomorrow, Mr. Brown? 2:00, V454, that would be our last oral submission session. So we will see you all then. Thank you again to you, ma'am, for participating from the department. We do appreciate your presence. Thank you very much, and we'll see you tomorrow. Thank you. Thank you very much.